Indeed, here I am. My guest is Robert Young Pelton, and he writes about adventure. He writes about going into dangerous places and coming back alive. So he's here to talk about it. Now, a lot of Americans, many Americans, live very cocooned lives. And for many, that's all right. For some of you, I know, you kind of have an urge. You can kind of feel a little bit of Robert Young Pelton's, his spark for adventure, and perhaps you want to give it a try yourself. So you may well have questions about something he's done or something you would like to do. You're really never too old to get out there and give it a shot, you know? So there you've got it. We're going to open up the lines. If you have anything you'd like to ask, now would be the time. And in a moment, we gave you the numbers, the portals to get in. Robert Young Pelton at your service. Once again, Robert Young Pelton. Is there anything, Robert, that we have not touched on in the interview that really is important to get out before we go to the lines here?
Well, one of the things that I really wanted to talk about was, now that I've gained this sort of experience by being in over three dozen wars and being with all these rebel groups and whatever, I tend to focus my attentions now on weird developments or sort of strange subsets that are fighting wars. And my current book, which is called License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, came about because a number of people that I know that were fighting wars told me they became contractors. And these are South African mercenaries, these are U.S. Special Forces soldiers, even L.A. cops. And I spent the last 3 years traveling around the world to Iraq, Afghanistan, Liberia, Equatorial Guinea, trying to get inside, which I did, I think, rather well, this phenomena of hired guns. And, right now we have 70,000 hired guns in Iraq, about half of them Iraqi and half of them expats, and we're beginning to privatize warfare. And I thought that was a fascinating development.
It is a fascinating development. And I guess it's kind of like the accusations here of extra judicial killings. I mean, how much difference is there?
Well, it means there's a failed state. If the state can't control violence or doesn't have a monopoly on the use of lethal force and it becomes privatized, then the state no longer is in charge. So the rise of private militias, hiring hitmen, criminal groups, you name it, is a sign that something's wrong.
That the state can't take care of it, so they send it to private contractors.
Or people hire their own people. I mean, when you look at New Orleans, the state failed. You had a disaster. You had a government set up organization that was supposed to deal with it. People took the law into their own hands. Within days, they had over 400 private contractors providing security to private citizens. And one of the weirdest things was watching mercenaries guarding FEMA against its own people, because of the number of irate people who were angry and frustrated that FEMA wasn't doing their job. Well, they hired Blackwater to guard them against the people they're supposed to serve. And that's a bizarre development in American politics.
How thin is the string that holds civilization together? I mean, is New Orleans a good example of how really thin it is? I mean, things can go to hell pretty quickly.
Yeah, we believe in just-in-time concept. In other words, everything that goes into your grocery store, everything that you need to eat, medicines, whatever, doesn't sit in stockpile somewhere. It comes from a centralized warehouse. Look at the riots in L.A. in the mid-90s. We went from a nice, fat, rich city to Beirut in within minutes. Look at Katrina. The things that were supposed to work stopped working. Look at places like Iraq. Now, you may not call Iraq civilized, but before the war, it was a very dull, boring place in which we had huge freeways and nice big buildings. It devolved into rioting and chaos within days. So civilization is not a thick crust as we like to think it is.
It's quite true. Even if you look at here in the Philippines, there was Marcos. Now, Marcos was widely regarded as a a dictator, and he was a dictator, but, you know, I'll tell you, he did a lot of good things for the Philippines. He built a lot of infrastructure here in the Philippines and got things done. Now, he did it in a dictatorial way, but when you talk to some Filipinos, they're not, they don't hate Marcos all that much. We've got the Marcos Highway here, the Marcos Bridges. We've got a lot of infrastructure that was built by Marcos.
But the problem is that the brutal dictators are strong men, if you want to call them that, stop change. They repress the forward movement that has to happen at some time. So as soon as they are gone, boom, all of a sudden that change happens rapidly.
It sure does. And people who are not used to handling freedom can't handle it.
Right.
And so there's this period of time that you talked about a little while ago when everything just sort of goes to hell.
Well, think about it. Maybe part of civilization is the yin and yang of peace and violence.
Perhaps so.
That maybe violence is the cleansing part of overthrowing corrupt old regimes and bringing new life and allowing poor people or people that are repressed to come to the forefront. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I notice it over and over again as I travel around the world.
All right, let's go to line, see what people have. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Robert Young-Pelton. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? I got a quick two-part question here. First of all, in Iraq, it's my understanding that it used to be divided up into three, you know, countries or territories, one with the Sunnis, one with the Kurds, and an area with the Shiites. And I guess the British came in and developed the country of Iraq. And I'm wondering, is that true?
Yeah, what happened is that under the Ottomans, they had three sort of governates, if you want to call them that. The British, as they did in Saudi Arabia, figured they needed to extract the oil, so they combined these three groups together to essentially create a streamlined way to pull the oil out of the country.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured. I think we ought to go back to that, you know, because people evidently can't get along. You know?
That's like saying, let's have the Indians live in the plains and let's go live in the cities. You can't go backwards in history. So what has happened is that people have mingled, things have changed. Like any other country with problems, it's up to them to resolve what they want to do with or without our help. And that's the problem, is that we are sort of sitting in the middle of a marital dispute. You know, we're getting whacked, you know, as people try to kill each other. One thing you'll find is that you can never fix countries. You can help them, but you can't fix them.
Yeah, that's for sure. Did you mention earlier that you were embedded with the Chechen rebels?
I've never been embedded. I don't think anybody would want to be embedded. But yeah.
No, I thought, that, you know, as a reporter or whatever in the
I was a traveler. I was there. I went with two Americans who went to fight, and I was there ostensibly to take somebody's wife out of the country, but she had already left, so I stayed with the rebels in Grozny.
Yeah, I don't have much admiration for them, especially after what happened in Beslan.
Well, don't forget, those are a mix of people, but, you know, if we have another 5 hours, I'll tell you the history of Chechnya, but the bottom line is the Chechens were an independent country, and Russia screwed them, so they had to fight for what they could fight for. And,
yeah, but those poor kids that had to suffer, you know, it's horrible, but thank you
much. All right, thank you very much, caller, and take care. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Robert Young-Pelton. Hi.
Hello, Art.
Howdy.
How you doing? Mr. Bill here.
Yes.
I commend your screener, Gina, wonderful lady, and I've talked to you many times concerning EVPs, reverse doctrine, the doctrine of reversibility, and subliminal suggestion.
Okay.
My statement, and then my question for Robert is, Robert, I've been an avid listener of radio since 1970, late 70s, all the 80s and the 90s, and radio and television. And I always ask the questions that nobody ever seems to ask on all the programs and all the books.
Go ahead and ask one.
Because I was a subcontractor for Raytheon and Hughes before Raytheon became Hughes, which makes...
Okay, well, go ahead and ask your question.
My question is, all the genre about Pakistan and India having the nuclear bomb is basically a genre that America has put out through the news and through the worldwide media to make us believe that those nations actually own those bombs.
Okay, you're saying they, caller, you're saying they don't have them?
No, they don't. They
okay.
don't.
Okay. All right. Robert.
I'll have to admit I've never physically seen them, but they're not bombs. They're missiles. They're weaponized delivery systems with nuclear warheads on them. Now, would they work when they hit there? But they've had nuclear tests, and I think that's how we determine whether a country owns nuclear weapons or not. And then we have monitored tests on both sides.
And of course, there is the recent test by North Korea. I guess the final word is in, and it was a nuclear device that went off. Whatever the yield was, it was a nuclear device that went off. We made an awful lot of noise, Robert, about what we would do if they did that, and they did, and we didn't do much of anything that I can see.
Well, one of the humorous things about the whole concept of weapons of mass destruction is that... yes, there it is. Yes, they have it. Yes, they're a rogue nation, and yes, they're threatening America, and we do nothing about it. And that's not to say that something is not happening covertly as we speak, but Iraq didn't have it. They weren't threatening us, and yet we chose to go in there. So, I thought it was a joke. I was in Afghanistan, and I came back, and they said they're going to invade Iraq. I thought they were just sort of posturing. I didn't realize it actually was going to happen until I met a woman who drank too much, and she was a loadmaster for the Air Force, and she says, yeah, we're palletizing for Iraq right now. And I thought, oh, God.
Yeah, I was so against our going into Iraq and said so publicly again and again and again. Now, since it was not weapons of mass destruction, I think we all know that now, why did we do it?
Well... In the grand plan, and that is the grand plan is to bring stability to the civilized world, there are rogue nations. North Korea is one of them. We consider Iran a rogue nation, and Iraq was the other one. These are people who have military powers who use them capriciously. Because they had invaded Kuwait before, we assumed that Saddam was going to do something bizarre and strange. And so the policy in the Bush administration at the time was let's get it over with, you know, rather than wait for these guys to come to us. We're on a war footing. Let's get it done. We did win the war within a few days. It was the peace we lost, and that was just a lack of planning. We assumed because of Afghanistan that people would rise up and cheer us. Well, they did, but they also believed that we were going to leave and let them get down to their business.
So we should have declared victory and left.
Yeah, we stated we are here to find weapons of mass destruction, but the obvious thing we were doing is we were deposing Saddam Hussein. You can give people their freedom, but when you stay and you tell them how to use that freedom, it's not freedom anymore.
But at the same time, you're saying while they don't need Saddam Hussein, they need somebody with some degree of iron fist like Saddam.
Well, the transitional period, you know, from a brutal dictatorship to a sort of full democracy is usually through socialism. You know, Iraq was socialized. It was a quasi-secular nation. What should have happened is we should have kept all the bureaucratic people in place. We should have kept the money flowing to the military, to the public servants, so that we didn't have thousands of unemployed young males on the street.
All right. Wildcard line. Christina, hello. You're on the air.
Hello, Art, and I'm praying for you and Aaron.
Thank
your
you.
Little being. Anyway, good luck. I will continue to pray. Robert, I think you're very fascinating. I could ask you a lot of questions, but how about, could you tell me something about the Seychelles?
The Seychelles?
Right.
One of my favorite places.
I want to go there.
Well, go.
To live.
It's an unusual place in that it's quite expensive. It has a beautiful sort of granite topography. And if you see a lot of fashion shoes, takes there. But if you go to Pralin, it's a place with no cars, a lot of very affluent French people lying half naked, and it's quite nice for a vacation. But there's absolutely nothing dangerous there.
See? Perfect, huh?
Yeah.
There you go. There's your answer. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of that. And and I'm sure your books serve up a lot of that. Do you document, as well as documenting the dangerous places, Robert, do you document those that are not so dangerous and that are fun to go to?
Well, I used to own Fielding's Travel Guides. I used to publish about 50 books a year about very dull, boring places, and I found that that was a very dull, boring thing to do because with the advent of the Internet and cheap airfares, it's actually cheaper just to go there. You can rent a car just about anywhere in the world. You can stay in a chain hotel, eat in a McDonald's, buy a Starbucks. The world is actually a very safe and easy place to navigate these days.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with Robert Young-Pelton. Hi.
Hi, my name is Eric. I talked to you before. I really enjoyed the conversation tonight.
Yes, Eric.
Thank you very much. I was just wondering in regards to your comments before about how we're comfortable here in the U.S., which I totally agree with you on, and what our country looks like from the outside to other people. What can we do here in the country on a home front basis as far as changing that perception here?
Good question. You know, we have all the tools. We are probably the most privileged nation on earth. It starts with learning about other cultures. It can be something as silly as eating in a foreign restaurant or learning a different language or watching one of those wacky cable channels that you don't understand. It's really an effort to just expand your awareness of the world. The other thing is to study history. I've always found that history provides most of the answers that we're looking for in something that happened 100 years ago, 20 years ago, or even 1,000 years ago. I'd say if we could replace Paris Hilton with a history teacher, our country would be a lot better off.
Yeah, we are very infotainment-oriented, aren't we?
Well, there's lessons to be learned that are being lost at a prodigious rate. One of the things that bothered me a lot was the value of the wisdom of millions of people that have come before us. And our focus is not necessarily on picking up that wisdom. It's on sort of trivializing the time we have to spend. Like when you watch kids playing video games, I just wish they were sort of reading history books.
So do I. Keith in Hamilton, Ontario, you're on with Robert Young-Pelton. Hi.
How are you doing, sir?
Fine.
I have two questions for you. I talked to your screener, a very cool person, question I want to ask is the UN voted Norway as the number one place to live. What do you think of it?
I was just in Norway.
Yeah.
It's an extremely wealthy country up there with Equatorial Guinea in terms of per capita wealth because of the oil there. They tax the bejesus out of the people there, and it's a very mono sort of lithic society. But they're also very concerned about world events, and the standard of living is very high. It's very expensive. But it's sort of a little oasis. I mean, they don't really have any problems there. And I don't know, it's an interesting place to learn about the world because things are so good there.
Mm-hmm. My ancestry is of Norwegian, so I was just kind of curious because I've never been there. Secondly, and this is a bit of a touchier question, again, I was talking to the screener, and she thought it was a very touchy subject, and I'll be very as light as I can, but it's regarding race. You said lack of money is a big cause of shootings and violence, and if you look at the rap world, the NFL and basketball, every day they are in the news for a gun crime.
Well, you know, one thing that you do learn is to be sensitive to race, and one thing that blew me away is that I can go to a place like Liberia, which is an English-speaking country with a, you know, looks like an American flag, and I was there during the war in 2002. And they actually sing those songs while they shoot people. In other words, the songs that kids sing here are actually very real over there. And then you suddenly realize that that goes even deeper to sort of a tribal thing, and that people are different, and those differences can divide people very quickly when there's a lot of stress. And one thing I was amazed about is that we don't really have any tribes over here, and people try not to describe people as sort of, he's from here, he's from there. But you see it around the world where people break into their sort of tribal structures.
Oh, isn't it true? And the other thing is, Americans don't realize how much their music and how much their motion pictures affect the rest of the world. What is known about America is mainly known through music and through motion pictures, and we're the king of that world, aren't we?
Well, you know, when I was in Liberia, the top films are Schwarzenegger, you know, Rambo, the violent films. They're actually painted on the walls, and they're all bullet-parked from the number of battles that have been fought there. The rap music takes on a completely different connotation. Fighters wear Tupac Shakur T-shirts. They don't even know.
On that note, we'll have to break, but boy, are you exactly right. It's ditto here. We'll be right back. I think one of my favorite lines tonight was loading up B-52s with $100 bills and then carpet bombing. That really is one of my favorites. In a moment, I'll tell you something that actually makes me very, very angry about the Philippines, country in which I now live. Stay right where you are. The Filipino people may be some of the happiest people in the entire world. And when I say that, I sincerely mean it. They are just a very, very happy. They will offer you a smile, a low, you know, just very, very happy people. However, most of the young people here have as a goal to leave the country. Not that they want to leave the country, it's that they have to leave the country to make any money. There's no jobs. Now, the Philippines is a very well-educated country, extremely well-educated. There are nurses. We turn out nurses from the Philippines like you wouldn't believe. We export nurses to the rest of the world and doctors to America and to other countries. The educational level is really quite good. My own wife is a school teacher. She graduated, and then to have any possibility of teaching, she would have had to go to a very mountainous area in on Mindanao and work her way toward the cities, which would have taken many, many years. But there are so many young people here with a high educational level that end up working at the equivalent of McDonald's, Jollibees, or a job of that sort. So the main drive here for young people, Robert, is to leave the country and then send money home. It's so sad. This should be a booming economy, and I can't figure out why it's not, except for corruption.
Well, it's not just that, but I mean, there are many countries like Mexico and Pakistan that has this diaspora, these people that have to go outside to make money, simply right. because they get paid more money than they do inside the country. And, you know, for years, Russia used to have an overeducated population that didn't have jobs. And, you know, can somebody invest in the Philippines and create jobs that keeps those people there? I don't know, because I think the future of the world is this sort of nomadic population of what they call them, guest workers or whatever you want to call them, flows to where the jobs pay the most. If you go to the Baghdad, where they're building a new American embassy, it's not being built by Americans. It's been built by people coming from multiplicity of nations simply because they're cheap and they're effective, and then they send
that's
them
right.
back when they're done.
Yeah, that's right. So, and it makes me angry. There ought to be, you know, other Asian nations have made such progress. If you look around the Asian Rim, even China, of course, is just going full steam ahead at the moment. Japan, South Korea, and on and on and on, really. And the Philippines has been kind of left out in the cold. And so many young people here are just so well educated. And the only way to make money is to leave the country. That's it.
Brain drain.
Brain drain indeed. First time caller line, Susan in San Diego. You're on with Robert Young Pelton.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Here's what I'm wondering. Clearly, it is commonly accepted that our government invaded Iraq with motives far more powerful than weapons of mass destruction. So my question is, Saddam Hussein has now lost power, lost wealth, lost his sons, his freedom, slept in a hidey hole, and is now in prison waiting to die by hanging. So I'm sure he's had plenty of time to think about that and think what he would have done differently had he to do that over again. And suppose, just for a minute, that he did have it to do over again, and suppose he just gave carte blanche to the inspectors to look anywhere they wanted for weapons of mass destruction.
Huh.
So our government now has put us in this huge debt and lost a lot of lives. So clearly they had a strong motive for going in. So if they did get carte blanche to go in and look at these weapons and they were not there, I'm wondering what excuse do you think they would have come up with to invade Iraq?
Well, kind of an interesting what if, I'd say.
Yeah, but the what if is actually true. One of the things I did was look for weapons of mass destruction. They were a collection of rockets that had chemical tips on them that I was told by a guy who was planning escape routes.
what I did find out is the UN did go anywhere they wanted to with very sophisticated equipment. We had people like Scott Ritter who were actually infiltrated in that UN mission as intelligence agents, and also the Mossad, feeding intelligence directly back to the intelligence agencies in each country. We knew there was no weapons of mass destruction. We knew exactly what was going on in Iraq because we spent 10 years bombing it, flying over it, and infiltrating it. We had dozens of expats that fled Iraq sort of feeding us exaggerated information. That's where it came from. So the bottom line is we knew exactly what was going on in Iraq, but we chose to cherry-pick the bits and pieces that would put together a premise for war.
So that was not the real premise for war.
Well, I was never in the White House, and a number of very good books have been written about the planning that went to war. And one of the things that knocked me back on my heels was Bob Woodward's first book, After 9/11, in which George Bush thought that the Iraqis had something to do with it. I guess it was in the cards from the second that George Bush Jr. Became president.
All right. Here we go to another wild card line. New York City, AI, is it, or AL?
Yeah, the last one. Hey, Art, great program. Robert, really appreciate your work. I'd like to ask my question and listen to your answer over the air. The first part of the question deals with about 3 weeks ago, a woman Russian journalist who was, you had started to tell, give us some greater insight into Chechnya, and she was assassinated, and there's been, I can't think of the number right now, but journalists in Russia, especially like the ones who try to give another view of Chechnya, are dying like flies. The other part of the question is that, you know, I'd like to see somebody with the way you approach things to give us some other view on 9/11, because I'm not hateful about those who say I don't believe my lying eyes, but Art had on John Lear, who had, Art, I don't remember how many thousand hours of flight time that he was a senior pilot and retired at that time, but he mentioned how difficult it would be for an experienced pilot to actually target and hit a building, not to mention all the other questions like like how Building 7 came down, you know, and how even the first two towers came down, Class A building. So I just want you to go in the direction with an open mind as to the scholars that have come together and people like David Griffin and many other others. And the last part is that, have you ever considered looking into the inner workings of, like, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilats, the Bilderbergers? Because I think you could give us a really unique view on, you know, how things are really ruled. And I love you, Art. I love you now, Robert, and I'll listen over the air. Thank you, guys.
All right, thank you. Well, that's a gigantic three-part question.
Well, first of all, they've never invited people like me to those cocktail parties, so I can't tell you anything about those commissions.
Okay.
The second thing on 9/11, my instant reaction when I saw the planes flying the building is that they finally did it. If you remember, the Egyptians tried to do it earlier with a Ryder truck with explosives, and they thought one of the towers would fall over and knock the other one over. It had been an ongoing fascination of the Egyptian and the Brotherhood to knock those towers down. I don't think that it's worth adding speculation to something that's already happened. I think what happened happened. You can't prevent it from happening again. All you can do is try to not overreact. In other words, not cause more damage by going after people who aren't involved in that. If you took a snapshot before 9/11, I, as an American citizen, could travel just about anywhere in the world and meet with any terrorist group and be on the ground and feel fairly comfortable. After 9/11, it's almost physically impossible to be with a number of terrorist groups because they just assume that you are the enemy now. And we forgot that people like the Taliban were not anti-American. They were actually very pro-American before 9/11. And that the murders of journalists and the ability to keep people out of war zones, you mentioned Anna Politkovskaya, is part of this new trend to keep normal citizens out of war zones so they can't form opinions outside of the media or the government. It's not a conspiracy. It's just common sense. You may not know that Anna Politkovskaya was poisoned on the way to go to Beslan. She was going to negotiate with the people that were holding the children, and she was poisoned by the FSB or the Russian government, so she couldn't go there. Andrei Babitsky, who was another famous Russian journalist who now has to live outside the country, was arrested and prevented from flying there so that the Russians could attack the school, which led to the death of the children.
All right. East of the Rockies, your turn with Robert Young Pelton. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Robert. This is John from Springfield, Illinois.
Yes, John.
I got a quick comment and two questions really quick. Art, I hope your wife isn't eating those rotten eggs when she's during her pregnancy, those eggs, those aphrodisiacs.
They're called balut, sir.
I'm sorry. She's not eating those, is she?
They're not exactly rotten eggs. They're from a Western perspective. They have a yuck factor. Anyway, go right ahead.
Okay, my first question, in Nicaragua, I want to see what your comment is about this Ortega winning the election. You know, coming out of nowhere, could this be a new North Korea-Iran axis plot? You know, I found it ironic. Oliver North was backing the Ruiz guy that was going against him. And my second question, I find it odd, too. China is negotiating with Iraq for oil leases, offering to put like hundreds of millions of dollars into infrastructure. What do you think about that?
Well, a couple of things. One is that things aren't quite going the way that the U.S. government wants them to go. If you look at Chavez and you look at Cuba being sort of independent for years, and you look at the rise of socialism in Latin America, we can't just keep going in and invading and overthrowing governments. At some point, the world is going to change without us. When you look at China, you're looking at something that harks back to my comment about using dollars instead of bullets. China is sitting back in the weeds, watching us thrash around, expend our precious resources, while they're basically building up capital and buying up most of the world's resources. In 20 to 50 years, the biggest enemy we will have will be China, and they will have already outspent us.
Oh, yes. Have you been to China recently?
Never been to China, never wanted to go.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Well, I'm saving that for when I'm old and senile, and I can...
It's a very sobering... Very sobering experience. To travel up above Hong Kong into the new territories will just scare the hell out of you. The amount of industry going on up there will remind you of the industrial age of America times 50.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just frightening. It's really frightening. All right. Well, we're so short on time. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, Art. Pleasure to talk to you.
And
My question for Robert is, in his travels, has he ever come across modern-day pirates, and what type of experiences he had with that?
I went hunting pirates in Sierra Leone, and yes, in the Philippines they have pirates. It's kind of a glorified term for a thug on a boat, but pirates are quite common and not very nice people, but they do exist, and they're easy to find.
Where did you find them here in the Philippines?
If you go down to Tawi-Tawi, you go to the islands. Abu Sayyaf are essentially pirates. They use boats to attack people. But piracy in the Sulu archipelago is quite common.
Okay. Kathy in Fresno, California, you're on with Robert Young Pelton.
Good morning, gentlemen. Do you feel, are they using any unconventional methods of finding the enemy, such as remote viewing or psychics, and then bring in the military forces? And then, Robert, do you feel that, since you know the area, is it possible to slowly bring home our soldiers, bring in humanitarians, such as the people that build homes and run businesses, and give these people the tools and the experience to rebuild their cities, if there's anything left, and to build an infrastructure? We could pay them with military money that we're paying our soldiers, and I'm wondering if people would volunteer their time to do that type of work rather than go into a military situation. Would they give their time?
Well, to answer your second question, you can't provide any kind of assistance without security. I mean, NGOs, well-intentioned people are not going to go into a situation in which what they build gets blown up. When I was there in July, I was with private security contractors with machine guns guarding gravel to build the police station. We got hit every day, and everybody knew when that police station was built, it was going to be blown up with a car bomb in the first month of it's being open. They have to sort their own problems, and if I had buttons and I was in charge, I would simply ask all U.S. troops to leave. And that's the fastest and cleanest way out of there. When they have figured out their problems, I'd be happy to go back and work very industriously to rebuild that country. But I'm not going to do it if I'm going to get killed.
The military is in the middle of what they call reassessing the war, I guess the goals of the war. And I wonder what you think they'll come up with. Do you think they will sort of do a Vietnamization of Iraq, slowly turning it over while we're leaving? Is that where we're headed?
No, the military can do one of two things. They can engage in a war, which is, in other words, against an enemy. And right now they're in a counterinsurgency, which is a very debilitating war for traditional military. Mm-hmm. Or they can choose to be peacekeepers. Well, there's no peace to keep. So our military can't win something that is not winnable.
First, wildcard line, I'm sorry. Michael in Kentucky, you're on the air.
Yes, Art. Very glad to get through. I've been listening to you since 94, I guess. My question is kind of unconventional, but do you think it's possible that these guys that are sending the suicide bombers out to blow up these innocent people are possibly hypnotizing them to go out and doing it? Because I cannot see why somebody would willingly do this.
Yeah, the Western mind cannot grasp, Robert, how anybody is convinced to do that. We just cannot in the West imagine that.
Well, it's quite easy. I mean, typically a suicide bomber prepares himself by praying and sort of, I won't say chanting, but basically reciting the Quran. He shaves, he dresses in white, he says goodbye to his family. He is instructed on how to detonate the device or the car, and then he is instructed on where to go and what to look for. Typically, these guys, as they blow themselves up, because when I was in Baghdad doing this, you actually tell the people that were suicide bombers because they were sort of in a trance. They were fixated. And once they detonated this button, of course, they never knew what hit them.
Okay. I suppose let's go all the way to Canada and Vancouver. You're on the air with Robert Young-Pelton. Hi.
Well, hi. I had the chance to go to Google Video, and I watched Terror Storm by Alex Jones. I'm wondering if your guest would have any comments about government-sponsored terrorism, including U.S. government-sponsored terrorism.
Well, terrorism is a buzzword. You know, it's like mercenaries used to describe something you don't like. Shock and awe was terrorism in its most primitive and brutal form. We engage in terrorism, our enemies engage in terrorism. To call it a war on terrorism is kind of humorous because it is the very fact that we have this sort of nameless, faceless enemy which terrorizes us. It's more appropriate to use other words that aren't just sort of empty, meaningless things. So every nation engages in terrorist activities. They just don't call them that.
Hmm. Robert, if somebody were to go out and buy one of your books, and you've got some really good ones here, what right now would you recommend to them? Where's a good place to start?
Well, go to Amazon and buy License to Kill. I think people would find that a very shocking entry into the world of privatized warfare. And you will see the future when you read that book. And it's 3 years of my life on the ground with mercenaries, with contractors, with CIA contractors, and trying to understand where warfare is going. And to me, it's one of my best books ever.
Were you ever, Robert, at a point where you could have been drawn in, instead of being an observer and visitor, instead being a participant?
Yes, but I have to stop myself, because as soon as I pick up a gun and I start joining a cause, I can no longer be of service to people, because then I'm just a partisan.
Indeed. All right. Listen, buddy, thank you very, very much for being here.
Pleasure, Art, to finally talk to you and be on the show with you.
Extremely educational for me, and I'm sure for many out there. You take care, and we'll do it again one day.
Thank you very much.
All right. There you have it, folks. Robert Young-Pelton, tomorrow night, we're going to move toward my favorite subject. It's all about time travel. Ron Mallett will be here. And all I can tell you is, anytime we're talking about time travel, and I'm involved, it's going to have to be good. That'll be tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. This night, good night, all.